The nominations for all 24 Oscar categories were announced this morning at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in Beverly Hills. And NPR's Mandalit Del Barco is there in the thick of it, by the way. Good morning, Mandalit.
Good morning. Yes, amongst all the journalists from around the world.
Right. So let us start with what movie, you know, came out the best this morning.
Well, looking purely at the numbers, Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, as it's called, got 9 nominations, including one for Michael Keaton as Best Actor. Now, you'll remember Michael Keaton years ago played Batman, and in this movie, he portrays an aging actor who once played a superhero known as Birdman. This is from the trailer.
We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy?
He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
All right, so Birdman, what else?
Another movie that got 9 nominations was The Grand Budapest Hotel, Wes Anderson's comedy. Also nominated for Best Picture was American Sniper, produced by Clint Eastwood. And Whiplash, The Imitation Game, The Theory of Everything, Selma, and Boyhood, Richard Linklater's ambitious film, which was made bit by bit over 12 years. We watched the actors Ellar Coltrane and Linklater's daughter Lorelai grow up on screen. Ethan Hawke plays their father and Patricia Arquette their mother. They were both nominated for Best Actors this morning. And from the beginning of the movie, these two characters are split up. And here's a clip from the movie in which Arquette talks to her son about why she remarried.
Why'd you even marry him? Such a jerk.
Well, Bill has his good qualities. You know, nobody's perfect. And now we have a family.
You already had a family.
Okay, so Boyhood up for Best Picture. In other words, in terms of who was nominated among the actors and actresses, you spoke of a couple.
Right.
But tell us some of the other highlights.
Here are some other ones. Benedict Cumberbatch, who's been in just about everything these days, he was nominated for his role in The Imitation Game. Eddie Redmayne, who plays Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything. And in terms of actresses, perennial Oscar winner Meryl Streep was nominated for her role in the musical Into the Woods. She's up against Marianne Cotillard in 2 Days, 1 Night, Felicity Jones in The Theory of Everything, Rosamund Pike in Gone Girl, Reese Witherspoon in Wild, and Julianne Moore in Still Alice. Now, Julianne Moore is considered to be the favorite in that category.
And, you know, finally, Mandalit, it's always worth mentioning who did not get nominated. It's interesting and sometimes sad. The snubs.
Well, Renee, everything is not awesome for the Lego movie, which did not get nominated for Best Animated Feature, despite being both a critical and commercial success. Author Gillian Flynn did not get nominated for adapting her best-selling thriller Gone Girl into a screenplay. Jennifer Aniston got snubbed for her role in the movie Cake. And perhaps most noteworthy is the movie Selma. This is a clip from the movie.
Mr. President, in the South, there have been thousands of racially motivated murders.
We need your help.
Dr. King, this thing's just going to have to wait.
It cannot wait.
You got one big issue, I got 101.
Selma it is.
Now, while Selma did get a Best Picture nomination, the director, Ava DuVernay, would have been the first African-American woman to be nominated, but she was not, and neither was the star of the film, David Oyelowo. It seemed like the Academy might have been moving in the direction of being more inclusive after 12 Years a Slave was nominated for 9 Oscars last year. It ultimately won 3. But this year, you don't see diversity as perhaps being something the Academy voters are thinking about. Renee, also interesting to consider that against the backdrop of a lot of news that's happening around the country over the past year.
And that's NPR's Mandalit Del Barco with this year's Oscar nominations announced this morning in Beverly Hills. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The stereotype of the lone genius, generally in popular culture and the real world, it's expected to be a man. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, that gender stereotype may have an impact on women in some academic fields.
Sarah Jane Leslie works at Princeton University as a philosopher,
which is a humanities discipline that has very few women.
She says philosophy is also one of those disciplines where the word genius gets thrown around a lot.
We wondered if there might be a connection between philosophers' disposition to place all this emphasis on the need for brilliance and the discipline's large gender gap.
So she and some colleagues surveyed philosophers and asked them, to be really good at philosophy, do you need natural talent? They asked the same question of scholars in 30 other fields. The result, published in the journal Science?
To the extent that a discipline expresses the belief that you have to have a special spark of brilliance to really be successful, we found that those disciplines had larger gender gaps.
There were fewer women in fields where genius was a perceived prerequisite. That rule didn't apply to just the usual genius-y fields like physics and math.
Music composition was definitely towards that end of the spectrum and correspondingly has very few women in it.
Genius composers like Mozart, genius physicists like Einstein, these icons are male. And Leslie believes that image is keeping women out.
Even though women are just as likely as men to have what it takes.
But not everyone thinks this genius effect is to blame. Lisa Randall is a theoretical physicist at Harvard. She says the problems women face in science are no different than they face in other professions.
I remember a long time ago, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker, a bunch of guys and one woman around a desk, and they said, that was a very good comment, Miss Tribbs. Would one of the guys here like to make it?
She thinks academia has the same problems as, say, business. Men talk over women at meetings, some women feel marginalized, and eventually they give up.
Is it really that because it's being associated with genius that this is happening? Or is it simply that people aren't listening to their ideas?
Hard to say. But in physics, at least, the number of women earning degrees is rising, slowly. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
We're getting a better idea today of what has made the current Ebola outbreak the worst ever recorded. The World Health Organization has just released a 14-part assessment of the crisis, what went wrong, and what needs to happen to finally stop the spread of the virus. NPR Global Health correspondent Jason Beaubien has been plowing through the report, and Jason, the WHO has the benefit of hindsight here, right? I mean, what's their assessment of why this Ebola epidemic has been so severe?
Basically, what they're describing here is a perfect storm, and they're linking it straight back to deforestation that was happening in that part of Guinea where the first case was originally found. There's some foreign mining companies, some foreign timber companies that have been working there. And the idea is there used to be these barriers between people and the bats, which are believed to be holding the virus. And this deforestation has allowed them to come into contact. The virus then jumps over to people. Once the virus gets a foothold in these countries where you've got some of the poorest countries in the world with some of these very weak health systems, it just really took off. And even though you've got weak health systems in these places, you have these reasonably decent transportation systems with buses and taxis that managed to move the virus. So they're saying that all of these conditions sort of contributed to it being the worst. And also just unique burial practices there. They linked back one case they found in Sierra Leone to 365 deaths from a single funeral.
And we should remind people that there have been more than 21,000 cases, right? This outbreak still isn't over. What does the report say, if anything, about the organization's own role, right, in the inability to contain the epidemic?
It gets into this to some degree. Chapter 7 is the key events in the WHO response, and then it goes into the WHO's technical support here. But all of this really casts the WHO as this sort of underfunded organization that's heroically leading the charge against the outbreak. And it is true, the WHO was there. They were on the ground. But the problem is that what they were doing clearly wasn't enough. You know, this is still going on now, as we just said. And to this day, their mandate is to support the local ministries of health in Liberia and Guinea and Sierra Leone. And so the WHO is viewed by some people in the world as supposedly this agency that's going to get in there and deal with any international disease crisis or outbreak. And that's how But it views itself very differently. It views itself as an agency that's supposed to support and provide technical advice and consultants to local ministries of health. So there's this contradiction there between its mandate and how it views itself and how some other people view it.
So buried further in those later chapters, anything about whether the WHO thinks its role needs to change?
Yes, there's an awareness of this. You know, one section right towards the end looks back to a flu outbreak that happened in 2009, and in a report written in 2010 that was quoted there, it said the world is ill-prepared to respond to a severe influenza pandemic or to any similarly global threatening public health emergency. Well, last year's Ebola outbreak again underscored that the world remains ill-prepared to deal with these types of crises. The WHO's board of directors is meeting later this month in Geneva. They're going to look back at the role of the WHO in this outbreak and try to look at, you know, what should be the role of the WHO in the 21st century. It doesn't have the funding, the tools, and most importantly, the international mandate it needs to take on the next major disease outbreak probably more forcefully.
Jason, thanks so much for explaining it to us.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Jason Beaubien on a new report from the World Health Organization examining the Ebola crisis.
Roughly 10,000 Americans reach retirement age every day. Of course, not everyone who turns 62 or 65 retires right away, but enough do that some companies worry about not having enough experienced workers. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has this report on companies taking action.
For 33 years, Dave Tobelman developed new products for General Mills, things like battered fish sticks and fruit snacks.
Make it look good, make it taste good, make sure the costs are right, make sure we can manufacture it consistently.
5 years ago, at age 57, Tobelman decided to hang up the lab coat around the same time as a number of other colleagues.
Yeah, I went to a lot of retirement parties.
Losing veteran workers is a challenge, even for big companies like General Mills.
Let's say you have 30 people retire in a year, and the average years of experience is 30 years. So you just had 1,000 years walk away. That's hard to lose.
The need is not across the board. Not all retirees are in demand. But the older worker brain drain is a big concern for industries like mining and healthcare, which are trying to retain older employees because demand is increasing and fewer younger workers are rising through the ranks. In a survey out this week, the Society for Human Resource Management reports a third of employers expect staffing problems in coming years. Mark Schmidt is executive director of the association's research arm.
When you have large numbers that are leaving and a pipeline that is not entirely as wide as the exit pipeline, you'll have temporary gaps.
Take, for example, the insurance business.
The average age is in the late 50s in this industry.
That's Sharon Emick, who sold an insurance business 5 years ago after three of the four partners reached retirement age. She then started Work at Home Vintage Employees, a company that contracts insurance industry retirees.
It's a big crisis within the industry where they're trying to recruit young talent and keep young talent, and the industry is constantly writing about the problem.
Employers are trying to hang on to older talent by offering flexible work hours, more attractive health care benefits, or having retirees return to mentor younger workers. And more people are, in fact, working later, either because they want to or have to. According to AARP, about 1 in 5 workers over the age of 65 works, compared to 1 in 10 three decades ago. Soon after retiring, Tobelman, the food product developer, returned to General Mills. He works through Your Encore, a staffing firm specializing in retiree placement. Procter & Gamble, Boeing, and other companies started Your Encore to prepare for baby boomers retiring. Tobelman says the benefits for the company are obvious.
I already know how to speak the language. I know how the company operates. I know how the businesses operate. I know how they make money. I know how projects proceed. I know all the processes.
At Michelin North America, more than 40% of the workforce is approaching retirement age. Retirees have, on average, 2.5 decades of experience. Dave Stafford, who heads human resources, says last year the company had to plan around losing most of a lab team made up entirely of older workers.
If we're doing our job well, we'll know that there's a risk. We'll start to staff to compensate for the fact that that risk may come to fruition.
Michelin encourages retirees to stick around part-time, especially those in technical maintenance, where talent is chronically scarce. But it's not always easy to accommodate. Dale Sweary is HR director for Stanley Consultants, an engineering consulting firm based in Muscatine, Iowa.
Sometimes they have a very limited number of hours that they want to work, and to try to work around their schedule sometimes can be a bit of a challenge.
But Sweary says the company has always offered phased retirement because experienced workers have relationships with clients that are valuable to hang on to.
It's kind of a running joke around here that we have their retirement party on a Friday and they show up for work again on Monday.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Well, Renee, it's a little early for Easter, but Cadbury is already stocking stores in England with those iconic cream eggs.
Those chocolate eggs filled with gooey candy whites and yolk.
I think heavy eggs are amazing. I found some in my Christmas stocking and I tried some and it was really, really good. They're better than normal eggs.
Yeah, true.
They taste scrumptious.
In London, we caught up with some candy experts, 7 and 8-year-olds, including Will Langdale, Victoria Griffin, Kate Fittett, Emily Knight.
Also, Carla Skinner, George Mann, and Max von der Linden. They were, isn't this appropriate, walking out of a kid's production of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
But earlier this week, Cadbury did the unthinkable, daring to tweak its cream eggs in the UK. First, Cadbury reduced the number in a pack from 6 to 5 without dropping the price by an egg.
How dare they? And they have changed the chocolate shell. What's been Cadbury's dairy milk for over 4 decades is now, quote, standard cocoa mix chocolate. Our candy experts were skeptical.
What's the point of changing it anyway?
Yeah, what's
point? Actually the point?
There's no point in
it's
no
already
point.
Delicious.
Yeah. I think the old recipe was actually kind of better.
I like the new recipe.
Seems the jury's still out for the younger set. Grown-ups, on the other hand, are furious. Words like outraged, shell-shocked, abomination are all over the British press and social media.
Which makes us wonder, what is the big deal? Our food editor at NPR, Alison Richards, says for Brits of a certain age, this is like messing with a perfect candy time capsule.
You know, Christmas would be over, life would be a bit dreary and grey. And then, you know, the first Cadbury's cream eggs would start to show up in their glittery coloured paper. Mm-hmm. And this would be like, you know, a promise of things to come. Forget daffodils. It was the Cadbury's cream egg.
All about the eggs.
All about the eggs. It was a treat.
A seasonal treat. We tried to find some near us in Washington, D.C., but no store had them in stock yet. So, to be clear,
I haven't tried one of these new versions.
Okay, full disclosure. You might end up loving it.
I might end up loving it.
Chocolatier Paul A. Young did not end up loving these new Cadbury eggs, Renee, when he did do a taste test for the BBC.
It's a different texture. It's very, very pasty. It's just the kind of the chocolate is now as sweet as the filling.
Well, too late. Cadbury's unlikely to backtrack. It's now owned by Mondelez, a spinoff from Kraft.
And their UK office did not respond to our official request for comment, but they are quoted as saying, quote, a range of economic factors influenced the decision to change this beloved Easter treat. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montagne.